This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to The Country Hour across South Australia and into New South Wales, Broken Hill. I'm Cassie Huff. Now, many farmers' eyes are firmly on the sky at the moment, waiting for a decent band of rainfall to form. So it's timely that the Ceduna weather radar has just finished its upgrade. So the big question now is, will it improve weather forecasts in the area?
Look, all of the improvements that we're making to the technology, not just at Ceduna but around the country, are about improving the quality and timeliness of the information that we're able to provide, especially to our farmers, which is, you know, a sector that's very close to my heart.
I'll bring you more details on that. And 100 years ago this month, rust was first detected in Australia. I'll bring you more information on the rust research that saves Australian wheat growers at least $1 billion a year. But first now to big news out of New South Wales. The state government there has announced a $50 million funding package to tackle the ongoing mouse plague. You probably have seen those hideous videos of mice everywhere, raining mice. I think I saw one coming out of an auger. This decision comes 2 days after the state's most influential rural lobby groups labelled it actually an economic and public health crisis. Mice are also being seen in some paddocks across South Australia as well, so it's pretty widespread. The New South Wales Minister for Agriculture, Adam Marshall, told Christy Reading that the money will go towards free baiting through free of charge grain treatment, and there'll also be rebates to help meet the cost of purchasing mouse bait.
We'll actually be taking the unprecedented step as a government of providing free mouse baits in the form of poison and treatment of grain for all primary producers that are battling the scourge of the mice plague. We'll be establishing more than eight free treatment stations. Local Land Services will be leading that across rural New South Wales, where farmers will be able to bring their grain in. We will actually purchase the poison. We will treat their grain absolutely free of charge using the most powerful poison that we can get our hands on in Australia, a poison called bromodiolone, which is currently illegal because it's so strong. And we've sought an urgent approval from the federal government's APVMA to distribute that. And we're very confident that'll be the case. So we won't be providing any rebates. We'll be providing free baits to all our primary producers to enable them to remove all of their cost of baiting for mice. Plus, obviously, continue to giving them that education program from Australia's leading mice experts on how to effectively use those baits and treated grain to stop the mice.
Okay, the free mice bait that you mentioned there, that will be limitless?
That's correct. It will be limitless, Christy. It will only be limited by our ability as government to purchase and get the chemical, but we've already sourced a number of suppliers for that. So this product is actually even stronger than the zinc phosphide, which we already have sought and received approval from the APVMA to use. To put it bluntly, Christy, this bromodiolone is the equivalent of napalming mice across rural New South Wales. We're really stepping it up. This chemical, this poison, will eliminate mice that take these baits within 24 hours. Zinc phosphide is also very effective, but usually takes 48 to 72 hours to work. This product will be less than one day from the point of ingestion to the mouse no longer being with us. So it's a much stronger option than anything that farmers have had access to before or access to at the moment, because it is at the moment not permitted to be used where we've sought that urgent approval, which we expect to come through, because we just want to step it up as high as we can to get on top of this mice plague. We're now hitting a critical point.
Do you think it's likely that you will increase these rebates if needed?
Look, maybe. At this stage, know, but maybe, Christy, as I said, if we need to do more as a government, we will.
Mm. We have had conversations around some of the baits and some of the challenges they can pose for natural bird life and the like. Where are you getting your information from? Who's advising you on these moves and these steps?
Local Land Services, the Department of Primary Industries and the Environment Protection Agency, the EPA, which in New South Wales regulates the use of poisons and chemicals under the Poisons Act. And thankfully, the EPA will grant their consent as well, just simply because they're aware of the devastating situation that these mice are causing. Using stronger poisons can and likely will have some other impacts to varying degrees on other animals that take these baits. But literally, Christy, we don't have any other control method for mice. There just isn't one. And we can't afford economically and socially to allow these mice to go around destroying crops, destroying fodder without taking these steps. We just can't. And that's the reality. So I guess there is going to be a cost to this for some other animals, but it's something that's been factored in, and we just have to take this step.
New South Wales Minister for Agriculture Adam Marshall. Hopefully it's enough to get on top of the problem that's been stretching out for a while now in New South Wales. Now, it's somewhat wet in parts of South Australia today. Still doesn't look like a proper break, though, but the upgrades to the Sagina weather radar have been completed, with the Bureau of Meteorology saying it's going to give locals access to more reliable and up-to-date information. General Manager of Agriculture at the BOM, Cindy Cassidy, says the improvements will benefit a lot of people in the community, including farmers, as well as fishermen, tourism operators and emergency services. She told Brooke Nindorf that everything went according to schedule, and they are happy to have the radar back online again.
It's received a new digital receiver and a control system, and some of the benefits that this new technology will allow us to deliver include tracking the location and strength of wind changes and improved rain image quality. There's also some other stuff that's really important around severe storm prediction and detecting weather systems as they move across the area, including such things as tornadoes. And I know that's a bit of an unusual one for Australia, where we think we don't have them, but yeah, they're quite they're reasonably common, and so having the ability to identify and detect those is really important. Some enhanced information for our emergency services around fire plume height and those sorts of things.
And has this kind of equipment been available and this kind of information been available from the Sagina radar before, or is this all new?
This is new and improved information and data that we're able to deliver as a result of the upgrade.
And the ability to track the winds, as you said, detect mm-hmm. the tornadoes, how will that help with emergency services, in particular, I'm guessing, bushfires?
Yeah, look, so there is some specific capability around being able to identify and estimate fire plume height and also detect fire-generated thunderstorms, so that, you know, that understanding that fires can create their own weather, and so being able to really better detect and understand that will be one of the strengths of this radar upgrade.
How far does this information go? Is it just for the Sagina region, or can it be used wider in the area?
There is a footprint. What we have got then is the network of radars around the country that work together to give us a more complete picture for the nation. So it's part of a network that we rely on.
This kind of information, is it available to people if they go onto the Bureau's website?
Yes, absolutely. So on our website, and also on the Bureau, the BOM app on your mobile phone, so you can click on and see the Sagina radar, or you can click on and see the network of information, the more holistic radar network.
And are these kind of upgrades or these kind of weather stations, is it something that there could potentially down the track be more of them put in different areas, or are these, keep it like it is and upgrade them as you need them?
Well, that's a really great question, because the upgrade of the Sagina radar is part of what is the most significant program of upgrades to Australia's radar and observation network in a generation. So we're in the the beginning stages of that right now, and by June 2024, the Bureau will have delivered 7 new radars, plus upgrades to 46 of our existing radars, and almost 700 automatic weather stations and 200 flood warning network sites across the country. So there is an enormous amount of work happening across the network right now to bring everything up to the highest quality that it can be.
Are you confident that this will help with better weather information available to locals and those that need it?
Absolutely. Like the community emergency services, local industry, which includes in your area, agriculture, aviation, tourism, as well as the resource and mining sector, will all benefit from the changes that we've made to the radar system and to the network more broadly. So there is just so much tactical information that people get from radars in terms of the weather that's coming over the horizon. And it's one of our, you know, most accessed pieces of information is the radar network.
And just finally, Cindy, I'm sure all the farmers will be wanting to know this, but can it predict rain better?
Look, all of the improvements that we're making to the technology, not just at Ceduna but around the country, are about improving the quality and timeliness of the information that we're able to provide, especially to our farmers, which is, you know, a sector that's very close to my heart.
Cindy Cassidy from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking to Brooke Nindorf there, and hopefully it does mean more accurate weather predictions. It's 16 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now to the southeast, where a Dartmoor timber treatment plant is once again up and running after a 13-year hiatus. Alliance Timber Group, who also run the timber mill in the town, have begun operating the plant. And here's operations manager Zach Westwick speaking to Selena Green.
We've got the treatment plant up and running, which has been a major coup for us and increased our staff from about 10 to 25.
So how long would it have been since that treatment plant was last being operational?
From what we've heard, I think it's about 13 years since that's been up and running.
Right. So I imagine that would have taken some major works and investment to get it to the stage?
Yeah, our maintenance manager, Brett's done a great job with that. And it's credit to him, really, to get that up and running because, yeah, not being running for those 13 years, there's obviously a lot of gremlins in the system that needed to be ironed out. So, yeah, he's done a great job.
Tell us a bit about what kind of output you're doing. It's posts that you're producing at the moment?
Yeah, so just timber posts, which is roundwoods. Yeah, basically through Victoria, South Australia, and even up to Queensland at the moment.
The demand for that right now, that's pretty strong?
Yeah, it's been consistent the last 3 years, really, but probably the last 12 months, it's really taken off again. So we're trying to keep up with orders at the moment, which is a good position to be in.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are you able to source enough wood? I mean, that's not an issue for you at the moment to get through the mill?
No, that's probably in the last 12 months we've had a few offers come through and secured a couple of contracts, which have really helped us. So at the moment, yeah, we're in a really fortunate position for wood coming in as well as going out.
And this undoubtedly quite a shot in the arm for Dartmoor after so many years of that mill or that facility sitting idle. As you say, you've been able to put on extra staff. So you're running a few shifts at the moment?
We're running the one shift, a couple of shifts in the treatment side of the business. But yeah, for a small town of 200, 300 people, it's just, as you say, a massive shot in the arm. And yeah, it's really good for the community.
Yeah. So is this the main sort of aim, was to get that treatment plant going? Are there more plans in the works for that site?
Yeah, so the treatment plant's been our main aim sort of in the crosshairs the last 12 months, but the next 6, 12, 18 months we're looking at further expansions and further additions to what we're doing here.
Alliance Timber Group's operations manager Zach Westwick speaking there. And just before we head to the weather, as I was saying before, did you know that the first wheat rust strain in Australia was identified at the University of Sydney 100 years ago this month, so May 1921. So it's been 100 years of continuous research that's underpinned, obviously, Australia's successful wheat industry. It's worth $6 billion a year. And this research program has evolved to have tentacles across the globe and now embraces powerful new technology and genomics. It's actually estimated that rust research saves Australian wheat growers at least $1 billion a year. Professor Robert Park is the Director of Cereal Rust Research at the University of Sydney.
So in the very early days when wheat was grown in Australia by the European settlers, they were getting wiped out year on year by stem rust. So stem rust is one of three rust diseases that infect wheat, and it is one that will actually kill wheat. Luckily, we haven't had any major problems with stem rust since 1973, when we had a major epidemic in southeastern Australia. So stem rust pretty much under control thanks to resistance breeding using genetics. The one that we've been having more difficulty with over the past 20 years has been stripe rust, and the main reason for that is that we've had a number of incursions of exotic races of stripe rust from overseas.
So it's been difficult to breed an alternative that is resistant to what we're seeing coming in from overseas?
Yeah, look, the difficulty with these exotic incursions is that we don't know when they'll come in or where they will come in from. And so the strains that come in are different. We can't prepare for them because we don't know in advance what they're going to be like. So that then makes it very, very difficult to breed preemptively for resistance to them.
So you're saying they come in. I thought our biosecurity here was pretty good in Australia.
Our biosecurity system in Australia is incredibly good. But what's happening is that people are travelling more. And this is what we believe has led to an increase in the frequency of these incursions. So rust borers, or rust diseases, I should say, they're caused by parasitic fungi. And they produce millions and millions of these microscopic spores that stick to clothing. And they remain viable for weeks. So you can be travelling somewhere in the world, and if you get rust on your clothing and come back to Australia and you don't wash your clothes, you can inadvertently bring them in with you. And we think this is what's been happening.
And where would they come from? Are we talking Europe? So someone might be wandering around in Italy or Germany and pick up some rust somewhere?
Yeah, well, look, we've been monitoring these rust pathogens since 1925. We've seen, I think we've documented 15 cases where we've had exotic rust strains coming to Australia. In the early days, we didn't know where they come from, but now that we're using genome sequencing, we're actually being able to trace these things back. And yes, a lot of them are coming from, we believe, from Europe, but there was one in 2002 that we believe came from either North America or North Africa.
And so what in terms of the research are we doing to try and get on top of this?
Well, over the last 20 to 30 years, what we've done is we've been able to identify sources of resistance, genetic resistance to these rusts that are more durable. So these are more difficult for some reason for the pathogens to change and overcome. So that means they're more broadly effective, not only here in Australia, but also to those exotic threats. So our work over the past 20 years has progressively been focusing more and more on these durable sources of resistance, and they provide a level of insurance against future possible future incursions of exotic rust isolates.
And how hard is it to do to breed this sort of wheat so it's resistant to these to this rust as well as breed other traits like, you know, drought tolerant or you know, the dwarf varieties? I mean, how hard is it to breed everything you want and sort of make the perfect wheat?
Yeah, look, that's a real challenge, packaging all those positive traits into one package that is a wheat variety is very, very challenging. But we've been very lucky with the advent of things like genome sequencing. We're now developing tools that accelerate that process and allow breeders to be able to select the right genes and package them together a lot faster.
And is that GMO wheat we're talking about?
No, it's not. It's traditionally bred wheat, so we can use a lot of DNA technologies that are absolutely not GMO, and we do that, and it is speeding up the process. We can actually do GMO wheat. The methods are there. They have been developed, but there's been no approval of GMO wheat anywhere in the world as of yet.
As of yet. But you think that might be something we might look at, or that the authorities might look at?
I think in future they will, yeah, for sure.
They'll have to, I suppose, if we're worried about food supply.
Well, look, there's really only two ways you can... Well, there are three ways you can control rust, but two principally. One is with fungicides, with pesticides, chemicals, and the other is with genetics. And, of course, chemicals are not really a sustainable way. They're very effective at controlling rust, but they're not really sustainable long-term. So the genetics is all important in providing a foundation and a more sustainable approach to rust control. And as time goes by and we need to, you know, package rust resistance more with genetically complex traits like heat tolerance and drought tolerance, that's where the GM stuff is really going to come into its own.
Professor Robert Park, Judith and David Coffey, who are the chairs at the University of Sydney, speaking there about the huge undertaking for the last 100 years, trying to keep a handle on rust, which does devastate crops right across the world. Right across to the Bureau of Meteorology, now where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Simon Timke. Good afternoon, Simon.
G'day, Cassie.
So, it's a little bit damp in Adelaide. How are things looking across the state?
Yeah, well, we've had a cold front move across the currently moving across the south of the state. Very early this morning, it moved across Kangaroo Island and then sort of around sunrise reached the Fleurieu Peninsula and the southern suburbs and of Adelaide and about the west coast there, and is steadily moving northwards now. Looking on the radar at the moment, we can see sort of the main band of showers moving across the southern part of the mid-north district and extending into the northwestern part of the Murraylands there, and that'll continue to move inland. So that sort of main band of showers will continue to move northwards and then gradually ease during the afternoon, probably contracting to near southern coasts by early this evening. Haven't had any big totals, but some noteworthy totals up to 9 a.m. this morning. The biggest totals were around the sort of the southern coastal parts and southern Mount Lofty ranges, just over 3 millimetres at Parowa, Mount Gambier, Cape Border, and then a number of places around the Mount Lofty ranges there. Since 9 a.m. The falls have been a little bit bigger, and again, mostly concentrated around the Mount Lofty ranges. The wettest place are 9 millimetres at Blair, and here in the city at West Terrace, 8.4 millimetres, and a number of spots around the Mount Lofty ranges and the Adelaide metro area picking up the order of 5 to 10 millimetres. And I think that's probably the upper limit on what we'll see. I think as that band moves northward, we'll probably not see quite that higher total, but around the ranges a chance of a few millimetres. And as I said, those showers, I think, pretty much contracting to near southern coasts this evening. And then there's another little front embedded in the southwesterly flow that will push up over the south again through the early hours of Friday morning. So for the southern agricultural area, most places will have a dry period through the evening and the very early hours of tomorrow morning, and then we'll see showers developing again during Friday morning, mostly about central and eastern parts of the southern agricultural area, but still a slight to medium chance of showers near western coasts and over remaining parts of the agricultural area, but probably struggling to see anything about the riverland or inland parts of Eastern Eyre Peninsula. So cool days both today and tomorrow, with those winds generally southwesterly today and a little bit fresh at times. We've got a strong wind warning out for the south central coast and upper and lower southeast coast, and that warning will continue into Friday. So some fresh winds near southern coasts, but elsewhere mostly light to moderate in strength. On Saturday, the next high will be getting closer, be centred south of Western Australia, so we'll see a bit of an easing of the wind. Chance of a little bit of early fog around the northern agricultural area and far south of the pastoral districts. Just a slight to medium chance of showers left over about the southern agricultural area, near western coasts, and about the coast over north of Spencer Gulf there as well. Conditions continuing cool with those southwest to southeasterly winds, fresh at times near southern coasts. On Sunday, the high will be centred south of the Bight. A cold morning in parts with some early fog and frost patches about the northern agricultural area and far south of the pastoral districts. A little bit of showery activity left about the southern agricultural area, but most likely about the southeast districts, I think, by Sunday. And again, a cool day with those winds persisting from that southwest to southeast quadrant. And then similar sort of conditions for Monday with a cold morning, bit of frost and fog around, again, mostly about the northern agricultural area, far south of the pastoral districts. Just a slight chance of showers near southern coasts and ranges and about the coasts of the gulfs as well. Rainfall totals, not too much, generally less than 5 millimetres, I think, from here on about the southern agricultural area, coastal parts of the Flinders and mid-north, but less than 1 millimetre elsewhere. And quick heads up for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week, generally dry conditions with some cold mornings too, Cassie.
Great. Thanks for that, Simon. And in the far west of New South Wales, it'll be sunny. Temperatures will get down to about 4 degrees, but up to 16 to 19 degrees. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, it's great to have your company today. I hope you're keeping warm in this cooler weather that the state is seeing at the moment. If you love your beer, keep listening because the state government is giving back a bit more tax to brewers. And I'll have a craft brewer on to explain what it will mean to them here in South Australia. And there's some great citizen science work happening in the north of the state. Students are collecting scats or animal poo, all in the name of science.
They'll then post those scats to a lady who will analyse all the scats for us. She'll pull them apart, look for things like bones, feathers, teeth, skulls, and from that we get really useful information about what species are present in the landscape.
And the kids are so excited. I'll have more on that shortly. But first, we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamachek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, Australians will have more coronavirus vaccine options towards the end of this year with the government securing new supplies. The federal government's announced it's reached a deal with Moderna to buy 10 million first doses, and then it's ordered 15 million doses of variant boosters. The federal court has ordered Telstra to pay a penalty of $50 million plus costs for its treatment of Indigenous customers in rural and remote Australia. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission last year found the telco had been selling mobile phone products and plans to Indigenous consumers who did not understand them and could not afford the products. And a woman in her 30s who's in hospital in Adelaide with COVID-19 has been intubated to help her breathe. SA Health says she's in a stable condition and is one of two people in hospital in our state with the disease. The other man in his 30s is also listed as being stable. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Well, as I was saying, after years of campaigning, the federal government has agreed to lift the beer excise tax rebate from a cap of $100,000 to $350,000. Now, this is something I spoke to Ryan Davidson, who is the Director of Sales and Brand Strategy at Little Bang Brewing, a craft brewery, about some time ago, and he joins me now. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
So in 2017, you were saying increasing the excise rebate on beer was important to your business. How much difference will it make now that the government is increasing it from $100,000 to
$350,000? It's an order of magnitude more important now than it was then. Or this change is, I really can't express how enormous this change is compared to the last one.
Why is that?
Not only has the rebate increased from the rebate amount increased from $100,000 to $350,000. They've also changed it from a 60% rebate to a 100% rebate, added to which they no longer require these small businesses to pay that very large tax bill before getting their rebate back several weeks later often. You now can just, much like the wine industry does, just while doing your taxes, write it off in one column against another, and you don't have to have that capital there just to give to the government to get back again. You know what I mean? You don't have to have those free funds all the time. So this is enormous, and a lot of breweries are looking to save that $250,000 plus per year now out of that.
And the craft brewing sector is a huge and growing sector. I think Independent Brewers Association said that Australia's independent brewers grew by 15% just in 2020 alone. But this is despite the actual beer market decreasing in that time. Is this going to attract more people and therefore more competition to your market?
Possibly there'll be more players in. I mean, it's still growing all the time. If data from the states is anything to go by, and it usually is, Australia very reliably follows trends in the US in the microbrewing sector, there will probably be a sort of a plateau, which I think we can see approaching, where there are still a lot of new breweries opening, but the closures come to meet that number. So there is just as many closing as there are opening, because for better or worse, it is opening a business in this industry is often a passion project for people. It can be something like a retirement project, or it can be people who've been working perhaps corporate, often higher paid jobs, and really dying for a change that means more about their job satisfaction and their quality of life than just their pay packet. So we get a lot of people coming into the industry just out of sheer passion. But what that means is a lot of these, I think we're 700 plus small breweries in Australia now, and a lot of them, it's not really spoken of that much, but a lot of them are actually run by people who aren't actually drawing a wage or making a living out of their business. So I think what this rebate amount is going to do is generate a kind of a tax-free threshold, much like in the wine industry, where it'll allow the smaller breweries, who make up the vast majority of the breweries in Australia, to actually thrive underneath that tax threshold. So I just think it's going to make these businesses at the small end of town much healthier, especially those that have a retail outlet of their own, like a tap room or their own bottle shop or something like that, where they can, or online, a good online store where they sell direct to the public. This is now allowing that to actually thrive rather than just, I'd say the previous rebate was allowing people to get in and get just far enough in to get themselves into trouble, you know?
Yeah. And who is actually eligible, therefore, for this change?
All breweries will get it. It just means the first 350,000 of their tax burden. So for quite a few breweries, that will be the entirety of it. Whereas a very large brewery will probably burn through that whole rebate in their first month or two of the year.
So will this make beer cheaper?
Potentially. The market price is still going to be sort of set by the big guys for whom a tax rebate is really neither here nor there at the scale of their businesses. What it will mean, I think, is that the little guys for whom this matters the most will be able to compete more in that space. So basically, this rebate will help to soak up the difference that the little guys miss out on by not having such economies of scale. Like a small brewery will probably pay 5 to 10 times more for their labels, for their malt, for their, twice as much for their hops, all sorts of things, not to mention more labour and rent per litre, et cetera, et cetera. So really what this is going to allow the small players to be on more of a level playing field with big guys. So I don't know if we're going to see prices dip sharply, but what we'll hopefully see is a more competitive space for small guys, therefore more interesting and just more choices in general for the consumer.
Another indicator of the strength of the market is that Bort Malt is reopening the malting facility at Cavan in the north of Adelaide. It's already got its Port Adelaide facility. What difference will that make to South Australian brewers?
It'll be great. We might be able to buy more malt direct within our own state. Yeah, often South Australian malt will be shipped interstate, processed and bagged up, and then we'll purchase it back from there. And with all those associated food miles and, tons of carbon burnt and stuff lost in transit and extra fees for freight, it's terrific to have more production within SA. And I think the craft beer industry will probably respond very strongly to that. We're all about sourcing things locally, not only because it keeps costs down, but I think we're in a parochial kind of business where our customers are mainly from our home state and our business exists within its home state. And it's really nice to be able to shake hands with the people that you work with. You know, being a small business person, you sometimes feel a little scared that these large entities might be better at business than we are, and you get a little scared when you get out of your depth. So it's good to be able to meet people face to face and shake them by the hand and know that they're you've got their number.
And they're sourcing South Australian South Australian barley to produce that malt. So you're continuing the story of provenance, I guess, for your beer as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's really nice. I think we saw it in COVID, particularly when we all got a bit, when a lot of the, you know, travel routes and even trade routes were shut down. That was the really heartening side of the COVID mess, was just how powerful the market is within South Australia itself. It was a very scary time for our business. We lost a lot of staff temporarily, but in that time we were pivoting very hard, but doing things like deliveries of beer and burgers to people's doors and stuff like that, and engaging really, really directly with our customers. And it was so heartening to do that, even though there was a lot of long hours and a lot of uncertainty. The positivity and the community feeling was just unbelievable. And I remember even thinking at the time, right in the thick of COVID, that I hope we preserve some of this going forward. And I really think it has. We always knew, you know, most South Australians know they're lucky to be here, and I think that's only been compounded.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Glad to talk about some good news.
Absolutely, yeah, thank you.
That was Little Bang Brewing's Director of Sales and Brand Strategy, Ryan Davidson, speaking there. Speaking of homegrown produce, pecan nuts are a fairly rare sight in South Australia, but Riverland farmer Dave de Grancy decided to give it a go more than a decade ago. The state's first commercial pecan farm is on track for a bumper crop after a devastating hailstorm wiped out all its nuts last year. Rural reporter Jessica Schremer caught up with Dave de Grancy at his farm to find out more.
We're standing here under the original tree on the property. This tree's about 65 years old, so it was well and truly here when we first bought it. It was just a single pecan tree. The variety's Western Sleigh. You can see from the base of it, it's over 300 millimetres thick at the trunk, at the base there. And every year this tree produces lots of pecans, every single year.
How long do they produce?
There's record of pecan trees producing for up to 400 years. So, yeah, I won't be here to see them run out of pecans, that's for sure.
While the trees can produce nuts for hundreds of years, Dave de Grancy's trees are still pretty young and are just starting to produce crops.
We started growing pecans 14 years ago. We had vines and export citrus on the property, and the market was starting a downturn with the vines. And then we had a terrible frost and we lost everything citrus and on our vineyard. So we decided to knock it over and then give pecans a go, because my wife's family from the United States were pecan growers over there. So I thought we'd try it here. We've got seven different varieties. We're currently walking under the Wichita variety, which is probably our most successful, and in the row next to us is Western Sleigh. It's quite interesting, most of them are named after Native American tribes.
We're standing here in front of your crop this year. What does it look like?
I'm really excited. We've got a good crop loading. Hopefully, you know, we should pull 4 to 5 ton off the property. At the moment, we're about 60% of our trees are actually producing. And they're still in their kind of teenager years, so they haven't fully matured yet. So we're very happy where it's sitting right now.
Especially given last year was quite a challenging year for you.
Yeah, last year we lost 100%, so we didn't pick a single pecan. We had a similar crop loading to this. It was very early in the season, but we had a lot of fruit set. And then I think it was November the 11th, I reckon, the hailstorm come in, and 4 minutes and 30 seconds, we had nothing left.
What does it feel like now actually seeing such a good crop this year?
I'll be honest with you, standing here right now, I'm pretty excited. You know, I love me pecans, and it's great to see the trees. They copped an absolute flogging last year, and there's evidence still present that you can see where the hail had damaged the bark and right down through the cambium layer. But to see these trees performing like they are now is very exciting. I'm really proud.
Where do most of your pecans go to at the moment?
At the moment, our biggest client's our gelati man in the city down in Adelaide. He goes through a lot of our pecans. We also supply to one of the biggest processors in Australia. We send some bulk to them just to help us out a bit. And then locally, bakeries and visitor information centres.
And your pecans are quite special in taste.
Yeah, apart from last year where we lost everything. 3 years prior to that, we came first, second and third in Australia in the pecan competition. So for 1 year, we had the big trophy sitting in our shed, which was great. And they're judged on appearance, size and obviously flavour. And luckily here, and I'm not going to take the credit for this, I think it's our climate, we produce pecans that have a beautiful maple syrup flavour aftertaste. And I think that's what puts us up there as a competitive grower.
And it's not just the taste that makes these Riverland pecans unique, because so far, not many farmers decided to grow the nuts in South Australia.
It's the first commercial pecan farm in the state, and we've also got the only processing facility here as well. It's awesome. It's only a little farm. We've got 355 trees, but I guess you've got to take those kind of things when you can get it.
Definitely. And what does demand for pecans look like?
Well, I think it's about education here. So far in Riverland, it's funny, we speak to a lot of people that really have never tried a pecan before. So it's trying to introduce people to the benefits, the health benefits of them, the ability to use them in so many cooking dishes. And they just taste really, really nice just to eat as they are. So I'd like to get the word out there more about how good they really are. And I think it would open up more markets for us for sure.
You've got geese here.
Yeah, we're not registered organic, we just try and grow organically. And yeah, we employ the services of a flock of geese to keep the weeds down. And they do a pretty good job, actually. They make their way throughout the whole farm and just, they mainly pick out the grasses. They don't like the broadleaf stuff too much, but they certainly do help. You can see where they've been.
What are some of the challenges growing pecans besides adverse weather events?
Well, I guess we're remote as far as the pecan industry goes. There's 90% of the trees are growing on the east coast of Australia, so we can't just go and pop over and see another pecan grower and get an idea of what they're doing. So we fly blind here a lot, but with the use of YouTube, which is where I've learned how to graft pecans and different farming techniques, the technology's helped us in that way for sure.
So you pretty much taught yourself a lot through watching YouTube videos?
Yeah, certainly. There's been many times where I've had my mobile phone resting on the tree as I've been trying to graft it, watching the video of this bloke that doesn't speak very good English. And yeah, I've made a few slips and got a few stitches, but now I'm getting reasonably good at it. And the problem with the pecans is that they have a terrible mortality rate with when you're grafting, unless you really, really know what you're doing. So over the years, I've probably lost several thousand trees through inexperience, but we're starting to get there now.
That must be a good feeling.
Yeah, I just walked up to my first tree I ever grafted, which is about two rows over from where we're standing right now, and she's loaded with pecans, and it was, yeah, pretty exciting to see that.
Is there one thing that you enjoy most about growing pecans?
I like walking through my trees and just the wildlife, the bird life that we have in the trees. It's just kind of created its own little eco-culture here. So, you know, it's a special place to be able to walk through something that you've planted. The trees are so big now, you know, they're around the kind of 12 to 14 metre mark, some of them, and it creates a beautiful shaded canopy, and it's just a beautiful, peaceful place to be.
Pecan grower Dave De Grancy speaking at his farm in Monash. He's done better than I have with the YouTube videos. I tried to teach myself to crochet and it did not work out well. So well done learning how to graft your pecan trees there. It is 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Sure has grabbed the headlines in South Australia this year. Now there are growing calls for fruit fly to be managed nationally. It was a key sentiment raised by many speakers at the National Fruit Fly Symposium held online last week. Lake Boga summer fruit grower and National Fruit Fly Council member Jolene Williams says it's a complicated issue because the crops are managed differently and there's a lot of players involved.
Growers in particular are always looking for the silver bullet, but it's not going to happen. It's always a combination of things and there's a lot of players in this space, so it makes it tricky and not one person in charge.
Yeah, one citrus grower in the Riverina told the conference he's spending $25,000 a year on managing fruit fly, and that's with things like cover sprays, baits and lures, good hygiene on his property by picking up dropped fruit and then rapid aim smart traps. But how essential is it for an entire district or even further to be on board with something like this?
I think that's the thing. As a commercial grower, you're actually judged on everything that happens within a 15 to 80K radius of your property. So you could have a spotlessly clean property with no fruit fly detection, but if the detection's within 15K of your property, that goes against you for quarantine purposes. So So that's why we need the whole community on board for these kind of things. I don't think the community realises how important they are to these large commercial operations.
What would make life easier for you and other fruit growers?
What we'd like here in Swanhill is an area-wide management program, like what we used to have. Abandoned farms to be cleaned up, that'd be nice. The government used to do that in the olden days. Roadside vegetation that could be harbouring fruit fly cleaned up, that'd be great. All the things that we can't control on farms need addressing. Abandoned and neglected trees in backyards, things like that. If people don't want them, take them out. It's pretty simple.
Normally when we've talked about fruit fly, it's in relation to the issues that you then have accessing export markets, but even selling fruit interstate is problematic, especially when everyone has different regulations. Is there anything that can be done to streamline that and make it easier for growers to understand what's required?
What a lot of us would like to see is a one-stop shop for growers to go to and plug in, this is my commodity, this is the market I want to access, what do I have to do? But let's just simplify and make the rules national rather than state by state. The same as like country by country, there is a lot of rules to follow. Sunraysia here, a lot of people have farms both sides of the river, New South and Vic. There's different rules for the pear. So you need to be quite aware of where you're sourcing fruit from or where you're sending it to.
In recent times, you've watched South Australia struggle with fruit fly. Do you think they could have been more prepared or learnt from experiences in other states?
It's really tragic that they didn't learn from what happened in Sunraysia. I feel they were more prepared than we were in Sunraysia, but I think there's a denial about what one fruit fly in a trap means. They think it's not that big of a problem, but it's more of a problem than they realise. You have to be really on the ball and really fast to try to get this thing out. If you're lax about it, think, oh, this cold winter will just take care of it. It's not going to happen. Hopefully they can get back on top of it. I know they're working really hard.
There's no long-term funding plans for fruit fly management. That's nationwide. What kind of impact does this have, especially in places like Sunraysia, Cobram and the Yarra Valley, where activities are being coordinated?
To hire good people and retain good people, you need to be able to assure them that you've got long-term programs in place. We spent more time shutting down programs and restarting them as the funding cycles went than we did actually doing work. And it's no different today. They're not sure whether they'll still be in business in 6 months' time. For staff members, that plays on their psyche, but then it becomes hard. You need longer-term planning to beat this pest, and that's really difficult at the moment with the funding.
The National Fruit Fly Council was established back in 2015. It involves government, industry representatives and growers. Last symposium that you had like this was back in 2018, and that was when there was a National Fruit Fly strategy, but it is still unfunded. What does the future look like? Are you likely to be getting back together in 2024 and still discussing the same issues and still facing the same problems?
Well, a few of us said we wouldn't go back if they hadn't come up with a plan. I think that's the problem. There are so many players, nobody's in charge. I think industry members that were attending made it very clear. Either make a decision that you are going to commit to a real plan with real funding, or tell us that we're on our own and we'll try to sort out as best we can. That's where we're at. And it was a topic of the 2018 conference as well, but it was a lot stronger at this one, I felt.
Lake Burgess Summer Fruit Grower and National Fruit Fly Council member Jolene Williams speaking to Kelly Hollingworth. Finally today, just a bit of giggling, a bit of smirking, but once they get over that, these outback kids will soon be helping researchers understand threats to native species by studying animal poo. Children from around the remote stations across South Australia have gathered in Port Augusta to learn how to identify animal scat on their properties, which they can then send to the local landscape board to get a better picture of what pests and native species live in those areas. Lucas Forbes went along to a workshop to find out what the kids would be learning.
A handler just pulled out a python in the classroom, and the kids are enthralled.
No, this is not a venomous snake. I will definitely not be doing...
Normally, these students would be studying by School of the Air, but they're in a classroom in Port Augusta to learn about how to identify animals from their scat. SA Aridlands Landscape Board community ecologist Kat Lynch says having children send in scat tells them more about the landscape and saves the organisation time and money.
Scats is a fancy word for animal poo, and we're starting a bit of a citizen science project with the kids whereby we want them to go out and look for animal scats on their property, particularly carnivore scats, so foxes, dogs and cats. And they're going to collect those scats, record a little bit of information on a data sheet about where the scats were collected, the date, specific location, different habitat types, that sort of thing. They'll then post those scats to a lady who will analyse all the scats for us. She'll pull them apart, look for things like bones, feathers, teeth, skulls, and from that we get really useful information about what species are present in the landscape. And the kids also get feedback and find out what's in those scats and get some really interesting information about what animals are present in their backyard.
So you mentioned that it's actually useful data. So how useful is it to your organisation?
Yeah, it can be really invaluable. Like I said, quite often from scats you'll find signs of species that we didn't know were present in a particular location and that sort of thing. It saves us having to go out and conduct really intensive surveys and look for particular species. Going out and collecting an animal scat is a pretty easy thing to do, and from that we can, yeah, as I said, find out where different species are present across the landscape and build build a better knowledge of that sort of thing and what threats there might be to native species in our kids' backyard and across the arid lands region.
So is it mainly about, I suppose, knowing where the native species are so they can be better preserved, or is it about knowing where the pests are so they can be presumably be better controlled?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, obviously. obviously our native species have a lot of threats in terms of introduce predators like cats and foxes and introduce herbivores like rabbits. So collecting scats lets us know if there's native species present, but it also gives us information about those threats as well. So, yeah, it's really useful from both sides.
When will you actually have the results from this load in the classroom?
Well, I guess it depends how quickly the kids go out and collect their scats and send them off. But, we're hoping in the next sort of 2 or 3 months we'll start getting a bit of information there and start finding out a bit more and let the kids know what they've found in their backyards.
SA Aridlands Landscape Board Community Ecologist Kat Lynch speaking. But how keen are children to track down animal scat on their stations? I spoke with a couple of students to find out.
I'm Lockie Keogh.
I'm Aurelia Reynolds.
What did you two think of all the animals we saw today? You saw a pretty good variety of animals today.
We saw like a sugar glider. That was my favourite and cutest one that I reckon we saw.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Aurelia? What was your favourite animal?
Well, we didn't look at animals in our year levels. We looked at animal tracks and animal poo and how you can tell apart the different animals.
And what did you think of that? Was that fun?
Yeah. It was fun trying to figure out which tracks belong to which animals.
And they're kind of trying to get you collect some animal poo to find out what's going on your station. What do you think about that? Are you two going to take part?
Yes, I think so.
And what about you, Lockie?
Well, I might just go into the stables and get some poo from my horse.
I think that's cheating. Isn't that cheating? Like, because they know there are horses on there.
Oh, yeah, I have to go find some random poo.
Yeah, that's definitely cheating. That was Lockie Keogh and Aurelia Reynolds ending that story from Lucas Forbes. Just a text in from Farmer Dave saying, it's good for the beer growers not to have to pay the rebate up front, but how about us farmers who have to pay road tax on our tractor fuel before we can apply for a rebate to claim that back? Thanks for your text, Farmer Dave. We'll find out what Sonia Feldhoff has in store with her program today. Hi, Sonia.
Isn't poo endlessly fascinating?
It is. For all ages.
Hey, I tell you what, there's been a first big test on the new lines on the Northern Expressway today with that big downpour. Has it made a difference to those problems a lot of people were having with seeing the lines? You know, because it's the white lines on the grey. They painted black around the white lines to make them more visible. I want to hear from you whether you've had a better experience in this rainy weather in actually seeing those lines. Because as I said,
now that they've done that paintwork.
Yeah, this is the first big test that was only started a few weeks ago. So we'd love to hear from you on that front. And also the deadline or D-Day is coming on the news regarding evictions, of the freeze on evictions from homes in this COVID environment. Should we be doing enough? How are we doing enough? Should we be changing that and looking at that again?
Lots to listen into on your ABC local radio. That's all that I have time for, though, in the program. It is coming up to 1 o'clock, almost time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.